This is your tech news briefing for Friday, October 23rd. I'm Amanda Llewellyn for The Wall Street Journal. All week, we've been bringing you conversations from our annual Tech Live conference, where we've been chatting with some of the biggest players in tech about the news that shapes the industry. We've heard from lawmakers and tech giants about the power of tech in society, learned how legacy companies are adapting their business strategies to a changing landscape, and today, we're going to talk about something that hits a little closer to home, tech equity. So many of us are being asked to work and study from home, sometimes with kids and other family members sharing computers and access to the internet. And that's making tech disparities between households, communities, and regions even more apparent. On today's episode, we're going to hear from the public and private sectors on how to bridge the digital divide. We have an FCC commissioner, Jessica Rosenworcel, and Kimberly Bryant, the founder and CEO of Black Girls Code, in a conversation moderated by our chief economics commentator, Greg Ipp. That's coming up after the break.
So today I'm happy to have with me two excellent guests to address, I think, a very significant issue that we've known about for a long time, but has become especially poignant during the pandemic, and that is the digital divide. A lot of us have, you know, with some bumps along the way, made a fairly smooth transition to living life on a screen. But there's a lot of folks out there who have not. And that is because there's continued to be, and before the pandemic, there were very large disparities between who had access to the types of tools necessary to live in this new virtual world and who had the skills and the background necessary to thrive in a world that looks like it will be more virtual in the future than in the past, even once the pandemic has passed. To talk about these trends, I have two terrific guests. Kimberly Bryant is the founder of Black Girls Code. Jessica Rosenworcel is a commissioner for the Federal Communications Commission. And I hope we'll have a great, robust discussion about these issues. Jessica, let me start with you. The digital divide, it's a very old term. It's been around a long time. What have we learned that's new about it from this pandemic?
Well, thank you for having me. And what's important to know is that the digital divide has been exposed in this pandemic. Because now we see conclusively the hard truth that our nation's gap in digital skills and digital access is very real and very big. And if in Washington we used to think about broadband and internet literacy as nice to have, this pandemic has proven that it is need to have. As a nation, we're online for school, for education, for work, for healthcare, for entertainment, and so much more. We've got to recognize that we are not going to live up to our civic and commercial potential if we don't find a way to connect everyone in this country.
You've talked about the homework gap as sort of like the analog to the digital divide. Tell us about that and what we've learned about it and why it now matters.
Yeah, so in the before times, before we were all at home, there was this thing that was happening that I noticed, which was that teachers were increasingly assigning homework that required internet access. But what I know from the FCC is that 1 in 3 households do not have broadband. And so the kids who lived in those households didn't just fall into a digital divide, they fell into a homework gap. They couldn't do their nightly schoolwork. I mean, when all of us were growing up, you know, we needed paper and a pencil and a clean, you know, spot on the kitchen table or on a desk. But you need internet access now to successfully participate in school. And that digital divide, that homework gap, has just become clearer in this crisis. We sent millions of kids home and told them to go to virtual classrooms. But if you don't have internet access, you're locked out of that virtual classroom. And we know it because we've seen chilling pictures on social media of kids sitting outside of fast food restaurants with laptops, just trying to access a free Wi-Fi signal so they can go to online school. And I just think in the United States of America, we should be able to come up with policies that close that homework gap so no child is left offline.
Thanks. Kimberly, let me turn to you now for a moment. Obviously, one of the things we know about the digital divide is that it's more pronounced among certain historically disadvantaged groups, including people of color and women. Black Girls Code, I believe, was founded to address both those things. Tell us a little bit about your organization, if you could, just to start out.
Absolutely. Thank you again for having me. Black Girls Code was founded right here in the Bay Area, where I am today. And our goal, as you said, is really to address this issue around diversity, inclusion, and even equity in the technology landscape. our focus is really to target girls from underrepresented communities. So African-American students, Hispanic students, Native American students who are traditionally disenfranchised from tech careers, which actually pay very large and lucrative incomes and can change the trajectory of families and if not communities. We do that by really introducing girls as young as 7 all the way through 18 plus to skills in technology and teaching them about coding, robotics, game development, et cetera. So we really try to introduce them to all of the different assets of the technology industry and also give them skills that allows them to either be creators, innovators, or the leaders of many of the tech companies we may see in the future.
What do girls get out of your program and programs like yours that they haven't been getting from schools? Where have our public schools been failing these girls?
Well, I think one of the things that we have all noticed as we started to really have robust conversations around this digital divide, that one of the barriers to access was students being able to learn these skills in the schools in which they were attending. So we're a bit better than we were 10 years ago when BGC was created. But we're still at a place where most schools and most K-12 schools don't offer any core curriculum in computer science. So what our organization is able to do is fill the gap, if you will. So where traditional education may not introduce girls to how to build a website, we do. Where they may not teach our students how to build a mobile application, we do that. So we're able to fill this knowledge and learning gap, which really creates access to further learning and growth and development once the students are in their post-secondary careers.
What's the impact of the pandemic been, first of all, on the classes and programs that you offer? And how has it sensitized, you know, girls out there to the need to acquire the types of skills that you're trying to provide them?
Well, one of the things that most impacted our work here at Black Girls Code is that until April of this year, almost all of our work was done in person. So we have 15 chapters across the U.S. We have a chapter in Joburg. They do classes throughout from January to December where girls are coming to sit in a classroom and learn and amongst their peers. We couldn't do that once we went into quarantine in mid-March, and parents were asking us, begging us in some cases, to give them tools to help their students to continue this learning process. So we took everything virtual. And exactly the things and the issues that Jessica mentioned around access to these opportunities are some of the things that we saw within our programs. So we were able to transition our curricula so that it could create a virtual platform for learning. But we are really supporting underrepresented and under-resourced communities. So in many cases, especially during this intensive summer that we just completed, we had to send laptops to students so that they could participate in the summer camps. We had students that didn't have access to broadband. And it's a little bit difficult to learn how to build a mobile app if you don't have one, a laptop to learn how to code on, and you too can't tap into the lesson plan because you don't have broadband Wi-Fi in your home. So this really exacerbated some of the inequities that we had seen in our communities before, but at an elevated level. Because when we're in person, we can bring everything. Like we bring the Wi-Fi access, we bring all the laptops, we bring all the phone, we bring it all to the students. But in this virtual world that we're in now, we can't do that as easily and as readily. So we see even greater inequities in the communities that we're trying to serve.
Jessica, what do you think of what you just heard? We've known, as I said, the digital divide is more pronounced among communities of color. What can policymakers like folks at the FCC or other policymakers do to address that?
Well, first, I'm in awe of Kimberly having been doing this for 10 years. We have so much more work to do to create a world where there's more digital equity and opportunity. So that's really amazing. But I'm struck about how much further we need to go. I think policymakers, when they approach the digital divide, need to acknowledge we have two different problems in this country, and we have to solve both. During the last few years during this administration, much of the discussion about the digital divide has been about rural America, places where the internet doesn't reach. And we've got to work to get infrastructure there, just like we did with basic telephony and rural electrification in the past. No excuses. We got to reach 100% of our households, just like we did water and electricity. We're going to have to make that happen. But there's a second problem in the digital divide, and that's adoption. It's often related to affordability in a sense that this world is not accessible or useful for someone. Because we see in the data that 3 to 4 times as many households in urban and suburban America don't have reliable and consistent internet access. We got to solve both the deployment digital divide and the adoption digital divide. And when we come out of this crisis and get to the other side, if we can do both of those things, I think we're going to revitalize a lot of economies and we're going to increase participation from more people in this economy. And it's going to be exciting because they won't just be digital consumers. It can make more of us into digital creators.
Jessica, you've also talked about a program that not many of us know about called E-Rate that your organization oversees. Tell us about that and your ideas for exploiting it to address the needs that you've just, and Kimberly, have just identified.
Yeah, so E-Rate, you may never have heard of it, but it's the nation's largest education technology program. And it's been around since the Telecommunications Act of 1996, which, you know, in the internet is a long time ago. I mean, I called the internet the information superhighway then. Maybe you did too. But back then, Congress tasked the Federal Communications Commission with developing this E-Rate program to help ensure every school in this country and our libraries too got fast internet connections. I mean, that's like pretty far thinking, right? To recognize that this information and this capacity was going to be essential for education in the future. So that's great. And over time, this program has been a quiet powerhouse. It has helped schools in every state in this country get their classrooms connected to the internet. So here we are in this pandemic. Why don't we use E-Rate to meet this moment? Why don't we use that same program to let our schools do things like loan out wireless hotspots from the school library? So every child can go home, go to online class, do their nightly homework, and not be excluded from digital age education. There's no reason why we couldn't use the E-Rate program to meet this moment and make sure that more kids get a fair shot at continuing to participate in school, not just during this pandemic, but on the other side.
Kimberly, going off of what Jessica just said, in your experience, how big a barrier are resources, money, to girls, especially from communities of color, trying to enter STEM fields?
Well, I think the economic barrier is a significant one, especially when you look across underrepresented communities. So African-American communities, as well as Latin American communities here in the U.S., traditionally have income discrepancies with their peers that impact their access to especially this extracurricular type of activities like Black Girls Code, but also to some of the things that students can learn on, use to learn more organically. So having a laptop at home that you can tinker around with and learn on. So that is a very real issue. However, I want to also point out that when we talk about this divide in the technology industry in particular, income is not the greatest issue that we see. So when we look across gender as well as race in the industry, also you will find that students that come from very wealthy households also don't see girls of color, don't see access to an exposure to these tools that we teach as their male peers do. So it's not just income, but I think income is a very key obstacle when we look at some of these tools, as Jessica mentioned, that our students will need to learn, to grow, to tinker, and just to be creative in this industry. And that's one of the things I think we need to address at the federal level and not just have that be the role of nonprofits like myself.
Well, you raise an interesting point about these non-income barriers. You know, Silicon Valley and tech in general, they're known for having a bro culture. You know, it's a very male-centric culture. How much of an issue is that for girls, especially girls of color? And I believe you've talked about, for example, girls start out with a very, you know, they enter elementary school with a similar level of interest in these subjects as boys, but that interest tends to die away over the subsequent years. What's behind that and how does that change?
Well, I think there's been studies that have shown the stereotype around what is a computer programmer and who does a computer programmer look like and represent. And I think it's those biases around who can do this work and who can do these things, even gaming, like who games. At one time, the typical image of a gamer was a white male. When you look at the actual numbers, you see an increasing gender interest in gaming. It's just not that we're not included in that, and games are not built that interest women and girls to the same extent that they do their male peers. So we see this phenomenon happening even in schools. So up to middle school, girls track a little bit higher even than their peers in their interest in computer science. But by the time they get to 12th grade, you know, less than 3% of high school girls say they're interested in computer science or technology. That's really what BGC is all about. It's like bringing these girls of like minds into these classrooms and into our communities and showing them that there are other girls that look like them that are interested in the same things and creating a safe space that they often don't find in the broader community. That allows them, I think, to build this self-confidence to push through the stereotype, these biases that they encounter even in classrooms when a girl shows up to learn about computer coding.
Jessica, you're not just a policymaker, you're a mom. Let me ask you, what have you seen in your career in terms of those gender gaps? And do you have any advice to employers and parents out there about addressing it?
You know, this whole discussion we're having is unique. I am rarely in a discussion where I'm on a panel with anyone else female. And a lot of times I get asked to participate on them to talk about STEM and women and opportunities and what we can do to diversify the pipeline. And I often find there's a lot of pearl clutching going on and woe is us, what can we do? And I've reached the point where I think the most important thing to do is amplify the people who are doing good things, because we're actually more diverse in technology than perhaps popular culture would let you see. And I just want to make sure that people like Kimberly get attention and others who make efforts to boost the presence of girls and minorities in technology get support. And then when there are people doing good things, let's make sure that the news media writes about them. I think when people see things, they can become them. And I think that's the most important task for the here and now.
Kimberly, we have a lot of folks attending this conference from the industry. We have executives, managers, founders, innovators, capitalists, venture capitalists. What's your advice to the broader technology community out there? We're obviously, as a country, having a much deeper conversation about racial disparities and opportunity than we've had in a very long time. There's an intensive interest among these folks about trying to deal with it and with inclusivity in a way that they have not done so in the past. What is your advice to those people who do want to get it right this time?
I think there are two really key levers for any business person across any vertical, VC, technology, corporate, government, around how to address this issue. It's to look at how your company creates access and opportunity. Those two different things, access and opportunity. So access means broadening your candidate pool when you're looking to fill these roles within your organization. Going to a historically Black college to recruit because they actually graduate more engineers than their peer organizations, rather than going to the traditional, like I'm right here in the Bay Area, Berkeley's right around the corner. But I also know that there's students within BGC that are graduating and getting their degrees from Howard University and Washington, D.C. So looking for diverse candidate pools and in unlikely places to ensure that your pool of candidates represents the global world that you're actually trying to reach. I think it's also about creating access very early and supporting pipeline programs like Black Girls Code, supporting efforts in your local school districts to bring computer science in. All of that is important because we don't want to wait until students are in college or about to graduate and look at a very limited pool to fill those roles that you're looking to put into your organization. And then making sure that you create opportunity so folks have a space at the table, not just to come in at an entry level and stay there, but how can you grow diverse talent at every level of your business from the boardroom on down? Because like Jessica said, if you can see it, then you can be it. So making sure we have role models and leaders throughout organizations that come from diverse backgrounds, diverse experiences, it's important to really create these safe spaces where diverse employees will feel that they can not only grow, but that they can thrive.
Jessica, how about you? Any advice as a policymaker to the folks tuning in here on how what they can do to address the digital divide? Is there a dearth of investment or innovation going on in the equipment and the innovations needed to fix the problems you've identified?
You know, a few things. I think that if we get 100% of us connected, we are going to be economically and culturally stronger in this country. So I think as a national policy, we need to say 100% is our goal. 100% of households with clean water, 100% of households with electricity, 100% of households with broadband. Now, it would have been a lot better if we had that policy before this pandemic. But let's not waste this crisis, and let's establish that as our goal at the national level, and then identify how national, state, and local policies can work together to support it. I think that's really how, as a nation, we advance in the digital age. I think it's really fundamental.
Okay, well, on that note, I'm going to bring the conversation to a close. Jessica and Kimberly, thank you very much for a stimulating discussion.
All right, that's it for Tech News Briefing this week. Production assistance came from Trinay Nuri, and Kateri Yoakum is the executive producer of Wall Street Journal Podcasts. If you like our show, please do rate and review us in your app store. It really does help. I'm your host, Amanda Llewellyn. Thanks for listening.